Hey guys, I'm your host Adam McCabe, and welcome to the Gay Footballers Podcast. If you're a returning listener, thank you so much for coming back for this episode. I hope you enjoy it. And also to all my new listeners, I'm really happy that you were able to find the podcast, and I hope you enjoy. For this week's episode, I had the pleasure of interviewing Lucy Rushton, the head of technical recruitment and analysis at Atlanta United FC. When I first started this podcast, I wanted it to predominantly be me interviewing individuals who worked in soccer but identified as LGBTQ. Along the way, I knew things could get repetitive, so I also periodically will include an episode of something that just interests me as a gay footballer. And this is one of those episodes here today with Lucy Rushton. Lucy has had an incredible career in terms of recruitment and analytics, and she's really inspiring to me as someone who has worked in analytics before and just looking to see how I can use those tools and that trade in terms of my passion of soccer. She's a really brilliant individual who has really done a lot for Atlanta United. I mean, she practically helped create the very first Atlanta United FC team, and has a really big influence in hand on all things that go around with player transfers, coaching transfers, and every little thing in between. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce you guys to the incredible Lucy Rushton. Lucy, I first want to really thank you for joining me today. I've been really excited for this interview, and I think the listeners here are really going to be fascinated by what it is you do and how you kind of got to this spot with Atlanta United. So if you'd go ahead and just really talk about, you know, how you got involved in football, what you studied in uni, and kind of your first jobs out of uni, I think that would be a great start.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me to begin with. It's a pleasure. Thinking back, 10 years ago now, I suppose it was when I first kind of maybe got my first job. But yeah, starting before that, back at uni. So I'd studied kind of like a sports management degree. And then as part of my degree, my research was in notational analysis. And I submitted my dissertation on that. And somebody from the University of Wales, Cardiff had seen it and suggested that I go and do the master's in sports performance analysis. And I'd never really at that time even heard of it, and kind of looked it up and read into it a bit more and thought, God, yeah, that sounds like exactly the kind of thing I want to do. So I kind of took the leap of faith a little bit and went and done my master's at UIC in sports performance analysis, and had some fantastic lecturers there. Peter O'Donoghue, Mike Lewis were there, and it was just fantastic. Say, like the leaders kind of performance analysis right back in the day. So I got a really good foundation from them guys, and then at the same time I was doing some work experience, which for me was just like crucial, because it's one thing having the kind of theoretical underpinning and all of that kind of stuff and having a degree, but actually another thing actually having the first-hand experience of working
actually
in
doing
teams.
It
actually being able to say that you know the basics day in day out of what it's like to be in that environment and to be working with a professional team. So I kind of got some work experience with Cardiff City, with the academy there, and again that was a learning curve for me, and it was everything you can imagine in being unglamorous and long nights and all of that kind of stuff. But it was really good for me to be able to have some experience of actually what it was like to code a game for a team, to produce a motivational video that was going to be used by somebody. So that was awesome for me and a really good experience. And I kind of then at the end of uni managed to get some part-time work with the English FA.
Awesome.
So that was kind of working and supporting the youth teams, so the women's and the men's, and doing some opposition analysis for the senior men's, which again just really exposed me to the different work environments and the the demands of the time pressures and everything of a typical analyst job. And I think whenever you're in this industry, that really kind of helps you. And if there was any advice I was going to give somebody who's looking to get into the industry, it would be to make sure that you get the work experience side of things as opposed to just going and getting the education.
So
I was there, and then the opportunity at Watford came up, which was my first job. I still remember to the day having the interview and say getting the offer for the position. And it was kind of surreal. And that was actually in player recruitment and scouting.
Okay.
So I went to Watford as a recruitment analyst, and was kind of delving into kind of similar to what I do here in terms of using the numbers to identify players, or using the numbers to look at players that we were already interested in and seeing if there was similar things objectively as subjectively. It was kind of a bit of a whirlwind in how it all come together really in the end. But
Watford, it's a great start, pretty massive club. Mm-hmm. Now in the Premier League. I mean, did you always know that you wanted to work in football? Did you play football growing up, or is that kind of, you know, you knew you wanted to be involved in football throughout your whole life?
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
God, yeah. I mean, yeah, I played football ever since I could walk, basically. With my dad and my brother in the back garden every night, playing FIFA on the computer when it was too dark to play outside. So football has always been my passion. I did play on and off when I was growing up. Yeah. Women's football when I was growing up was nowhere near where it is now, so the opportunities to play were much more limited. But I kind of had dips in and out of teams. I could never have dreamed of actually being able to work in football professionally, because, say, for a woman at the time, there was no professional opportunities to play.
Yeah.
And I suppose there were just no women in football clubs.
Yeah.
So for me, I never probably even envisaged that it was something that I could kind of pursue and a route I could go down. And it all just came together, and I suppose the right people believed in me at the right times, and it all went very well for me. So
yeah. And then, so after Watford, you kind of got the dream role with your hometown club. Which has to be such an amazing feeling. But so you were with Reading as well, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I was only at Watford for about 6 months when I got the opportunity to go to Reading, which, as you said, was my hometown club. I had a season ticket when I was there when I was younger. I played for their kind of women's equivalent team. So it was literally my junior, and the role was very much more in first team analysis as opposed to player recruitment and scouting, which at the time was probably where I was more interested in going anyway.
Yep.
So it was just an unbelievable opportunity for me, which I could never have turned down, and it was everything that I kind of wanted it to be and more. You have that extra little kick because it's your hometown team and the team you support. But to be involved, obviously, on something that, as a fan, you look at externally, and you don't get to see the inside stuff, like actually being a part of the team then, and just being part of being able to influence the team that I supported was just unreal.
And can you briefly speak about, I know this is probably a much more in-depth answer, but kind of the difference between those two roles, where with Reading you're more with the first team, and and what your role was with Watford?
Yeah, sure. So Watford, was player recruitment and scouting, which is, very similar to the role I do here at Atlanta United.
Yep.
In that I'm using data and my own kind of subjective opinions to scout for players and identify players that we may potentially want to bring to the club. So in that sense, we may use it at an early stage in the identification process to say, okay, there are millions and millions of players in the world. How do we whittle that down to a handful that we can actually go and watch? And we use data to identify players that fit our profile and maybe are statistically performing well or as we may like them to. We may use it at a later stage of the scouting process, whereby we've seen a player and subjectively we like him in games, and then we say, okay, well, what does the data say? Is the data kind of supporting what we think we've subjectively seen? And it's really a case of us being able to use data to build a good portfolio on the player that we then go and present to Darren, the club president, or Arthur, the owner of the club, when, you know, when we're asking him to spend his money, and we can say, look, we've done our homework, and these are all the reasons why we want to sign the player. So the player scouting and recruitment is very much driven towards external players and bringing players into the team. The role I had at Reading, which was first team analyst, was very much looking at your own team. So it's the day-to-day basics of coding your watching and coding your games live during a game, providing feedback to the coaches and the players in terms of their performance and the team's performance, assisting the first team manager in preparing feedback presentations and things like that for the players, but also the opposition analysis, which is a massive part of it. So the whole pre-match stuff in terms of going, okay, I would watch maybe 5 games on the opposition every week on who we're playing next, and then build out in-depth scouting reports in terms of like strengths and weaknesses, potential areas to exploit, how we might be best to play against them, certain players that might suit this game as opposed to other players, etc. So the role at Reading with the first team analysis is very much internal.
Yeah.
It's very much about looking at what you've already got here and providing direct performance feedback to the players and the coaching staff.
Yeah.
And say, we look internally in player scouting, obviously,
because we
need to know what we've already got in-house to see if there's someone, you know, is what we're looking at better than what we've already got or not. So we look at it internally that way, but with the first team analysis, it's very much more of a direct relationship with the first team coach. You travel with the team everywhere.
Yeah.
You live that life with them. So, yeah, they're very different roles.
Yeah, and I think something we spoke about previously is that role with the first team. I mean, both roles are very demanding, but that analyst role, you are literally traveling to every game. I mean, you probably just as much as the manager in terms of hours worked. I mean, it's a very tough role.
Yeah, it is tough, and people will see it maybe as, you know, a glamorous lifestyle because you're traveling with the first team and all of that, and the novelty soon wears off, let me tell you. It's very demanding in terms of hours, but also in terms of the pressure as well.
Yeah,
you know, you're as much in the results business as your manager is,
exactly,
in terms of you are as a team under pressure to perform and get results, and when you don't, you will often, you know, feel the brunt of that from the manager or have to deal with those situations.
Yeah.
And it's a tough position to be in also because, you know, as the person who has to deliver you get to deliver the good news when the stats are good.
Yep.
And let's look at the goals we've scored at the weekend and the good play. But on the flip side, when things aren't going for you and you're the person that has to deliver the bad feedback,
yeah,
and you're the one who has to keep hitting play and rewind and pause and skip on the goals that you've conceded and the defensive errors, it can be very challenging in those moments. And as you said, man, it's just long hours and long days. I think you'll see, like, first team analysts are generally quite young.
Yeah,
they're generally mid-20s, late 20s kind of thing, and then as people get to about, you know, the later 20s, 30s, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, the travel's too much.
I just can't. It's very difficult career to sustain for a long period just because of the sheer workload, really, with it.
Yeah.
And look, it's a fantastic job. I loved absolutely every second of it. But I think it just comes a stage where you need to maybe, hone in on social life a little bit.
Yeah. So speaking of managers, I mean, when I heard the list of people you have worked under, I was, one, amazed by just who you've worked for, but I think it's also interesting is there are so many different styles and philosophies that coaches have, and in these roles, how do you, I guess, adjust to a new manager? And there's got to be managers who love using data and managers who really don't care for it. So how in these roles do you kind of adjust, and what changes when a new manager comes in? Are you, you know, excited? Are you frightened? I mean, how in those types of situations, what's your thought process?
It's a really good question because it is a complete mixture of emotions. And when a manager leaves a club, often the analyst doesn't go as well, and so you are then waiting for the next manager to come in. But it is literally like you have, as an analyst, have just gone and got yourself a new job.
Yeah.
Because everything changes.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything in terms of what you do on a day-to-day basis, how you present stuff over a longer period. As you said, the interest in data compared to the non-interest in data, or the interest in video compared to the non-interest in video.
Yeah.
Everything, every manager is so unique in how they work. And the skill of an analyst is to be able to adapt to each manager and communicate and present data and video to them in the way that they see fit and that they best use it.
Yeah.
Because you can continue presenting tons of data and doing video in a particular way, and if it doesn't suit the skill set and the preferences of that manager, it's going to be useless. So you have to really adapt everything you do, and it's a complete overhaul of your work. But for me, that is it's almost like it's a fantastic process to go through, because you as an analyst get to learn about different ways of working and different ways of using data and different kind of means of feedback. And within football, you get educated on so many different philosophies and playing styles and ways of thinking, which, look, we all as soccer fans, football fans, watch a game and think that, oh, I would have done this and I would have done that and stuff like that. But it's not until you really kind of spend time with a professional elite manager or coach that the level of knowledge and the foundation that they have is just incredible. So to be able to work with different managers and actually just soak up all these different ideas from different people it becomes an asset to you as an analyst, because you can then employ those in your future roles and know, okay, this works well, or this is a good idea that I've had, like, based on how it's worked before. And you hit the nail on the head. Every manager is just completely unique. And, you know, I've worked with managers who aren't that taken by data, and others who have been incredibly into it in terms of wanting the most in-depth, detailed data ever. And so, say, the key in my role is communicating what is relevant, basically giving the manager what they want. At the end of the day, that's my job. I have to give them what they want. So it's a good role. It's a good dilemma.
And can you just for the listeners, let them know some of the managers you have worked under?
When I first started at Watford, it was Amy Boothroyd, and then Reading was my first manager, was Steve Coppell for the first year, who had been at the club a long time when I'd got there. It was his last year at the club. And then Brendan Rodgers took over from Steve Coppell.
Amazing.
And he was fantastic to work with as well. It's of no surprise to me to see where he's gone on in his career. And then Brian McDermott after that, who, of course, you know, we went on and we won the championship and had great success as a coaching staff and as a team. So he was incredible and still a very good friend today. Nigel Atkins after that, so currently now at Hull City.
Yeah.
And again, I think they're pushing their way up into the playoff places.
Yeah.
So just the most, you know, incredibly hardest working, like, manager and staff set you could ever kind of come across. Like, their attention to detail was meticulous. And then my final manager at Reading was Steve Clarke. So I left just a month or so before Steve Clarke kind of left. So it was a difficult period with his time at the club, just because of where the club was. But again, just very unique in how he used analysis and his way of dealing with the squad and everything. And I was actually transitioning over when Steve came in. I was transitioning over to more of a recruitment scouting kind of role at the time. So I was less involved in the first team stuff than I was with the other guys. But then obviously came to Atlanta and worked with Tata Martino here, who was just a completely different experience to all of the others. Obviously with the South American kind of background and influence, it's just a different kind of mentality. And obviously, you know, he's managed Barcelona, the biggest club in the world, and Argentina men's national team. So to be able to work alongside someone of that calibre, for me, was just, it was incredible. So, I mean, the list is, I mean, I say that now, I read the list and I'm like, wow, like, how lucky have I been to work with all these incredible, like, managers who have just instilled so much knowledge in me, both from a football side, but just from an analysis and a personal side of things too. Like, I've been very fortunate, yeah.
So before we switch gears to Atlanta United, I'm really curious, you know, how does your job change, or your atmosphere change when, I mean, you've worked with the clubs that have been relegated, they've been promoted, you've worked with a club that has just won an MLS Cup. I mean, the feeling, the pressures, they've got to be different depending on which situation you're in. Can you speak of that, please?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the interesting one is obviously, like, Reading, we won the championship and got promoted to the Premier League, and the vibe, like, people have often spoken about it, like, you know, winning teams, that there's just this mentality there.
Yeah.
And having been part of that, like, I completely understand. It was almost like we never entered a game just thinking, you know, we don't need to worry about preparing properly or anything, because it's a walkover. But we just had a belief that we were going to win, and that we could score goals, and that we were a team that would win games, and the kind of the togetherness in the squad was just unreal. And as a coaching staff, we were so tight as well, and you just felt it in the training ground. You went in every day, and everyone was pleased to be there. Mm-hmm. Everyone's walking around with smiles on their face. It's laughs. It's banter. It's good fun, and those are the best times. That is footballers and football staff at their best, you know, when it's almost like you, that the pressure is still there. The pressure is still there because you're at the top end and you're fighting so hard to be successful. So the pressure is just as bad or just as real as if you're at the bottom end or you're mid-table and you're not performing as well. The pressure to succeed is incredible. Flip, and, you know, 12 months later, we're in the Premier League and we're fighting for our place.
Yeah.
And we're relegation threatened, and we ultimately did get relegated. The mood and the vibe changes in that the pressure is as I said, a very different pressure.
Mm-hmm.
In that there's pressure in any football environment, but the negativity around the results is difficult when you're losing week in, week out.
Yeah.
To, you don't have that same morale and banter and
correct,
funny times that you would have if you're in a team that's performing well. So the pressure's the same, but you don't have that release because it's almost like you need to be serious because you're in a serious situation here. And so you have to really gauge the mood and the vibe around the place, and it does obviously, like, influence you as a person. You know, you're not quite as bouncy going into work in the morning and all of that kind of stuff. But as a team, and look, I mean, we had a phenomenal team that got us promoted in terms of our work ethic and our togetherness. I would never say that I felt that togetherness wasn't there. And I'm talking about even in periods, maybe, you know, when managers have lost their jobs and stuff, and so runs that we've been on, bad runs, like, players at the end of the day are players who care massively about their, what they're doing on the pitch, and it affects them personally as much as anybody else. If, you know, you're going into work and you have a really tough week at work, or you're not performing, like, or your department isn't performing, it affects you personally. And players are no different to that.
Yeah.
You know, they care massively about the results, and they're so competitive that when things aren't going their way, it becomes difficult.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to manage those situations, and you have to know the different characters of people and the different kind of ways that people are going to react to situations, because that's when obviously people can get prickly.
Yeah.
So you just have to you have to know, I think, who you're working with and develop that relationship whereby you know how to kind of act around certain people. But yeah, for sure, it's a really tough environment. And then say the flip of coming here to Atlanta and being part of a winning team again. It's just you just get that feel in the training ground, and you get that. And look, we had the result at Toronto on the last day of the season.
Yep.
The disappointment that came with that result, I think, was ultimately a good thing for us in terms that you see our squad. We could have gone two ways. You know, it could have broken the squad.
Exactly.
And could have caused arguments and rifts and all of that. But you saw the team come closer together and even more resolved and determined to kick on in the playoffs and actually get what we felt we deserved.
Exactly.
It's funny, success, failure can do, you learn a lot about people in both situations, in terms of, you know, when you're performing in successful and when you're performing in bad situations, you learn a lot about the people around you, whether that be the coaching staff or the players. And they're interesting times to be around, because say you really start to see the people who are committed to the project and who want to make it work and who are willing to put in the extra hours and to do whatever it takes to change a situation. So I wouldn't wish relegation on my worst enemy. Looking back, it's they're interesting experiences to have.
Yeah.
And they, I think, shape and help mold you into a better analyst the next year, or a better coach, or a better player.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't wish it on anyone. It's a miserable time.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and talk about, you know, a woman working in football and Reading, and now she's, you know, the head of technical recruitment and performance analysis here at Atlanta United. How did that come about? I mean,
good question,
what happened here? Yeah,
I don't know how this little girl from Woodley kind of like ended up here in big America, Atlanta. Like, I know it's and as I said earlier, like when I was growing up and stuff, like, could never have dreamed of having really a career, a full time job in football, because.
Yeah.
Of being in part a female, because of how difficult football is to get into anyway, but two, obviously the added kind of difficulty in being a female and the questions that raises.
Correct.
Has it been a problem, or has it posed difficulties for me? Like, I could say no, because I am where I am.
Yeah.
But yes, there have been probably times when you notice that you need to put in that little bit extra effort to get. Just to get the trust of somebody, maybe that initial trust, and so that's kind of something that I've dealt with in my career. But in terms of actually coming over to Atlanta, I'd been at Reading 8 years or so, and had loved my time there, but just felt like I needed a new challenge personally.
Yeah.
And then I heard about the role here, heard about what was going on in Atlanta. I remember speaking to Darren Eales, the club president, and he kind of said, have a look at this video of the stadium we're building and the training ground.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't not be blown away by it and think that, okay, you know, this is serious business. I mean, obviously the perception in England somewhat at the time is very much MLS, like, that's a step back potentially to Premier League or Championship, but... Having seen that, you could not look at the situation and say that this was not a serious club who meant serious business. And for me, the role itself, like, okay, I was coming in at the time to build the roster from scratch, to build a whole team,
which is pretty unique, I would say.
It's just like when do you get that opportunity to actually just build a whole team from scratch, blank canvas, and to go with it and to really influence that process. So for me, whatever I'd done in England could never really offer that, because everywhere in England is established, and you know, the role I was doing at Reading would be similar in any club, but you may have a bit bigger budget, or a bit of a different budget depending on your club. But coming over here and getting that opportunity to actually go, okay, well, this is, you know, this is your opportunity to do something and put your name on it from word go. It was like too good to turn down.
Yeah.
And it was just, the whole process was incredible.
That's, I mean, like you said, the fact that you are that really one of the main stamps of that, you know, the squad and that first roster, I mean, it's something I know you'll take with you, and it's, I'm sure, such an amazing learning experience. And now that we're on to, you know, year two, year three, and we continue to grow, I guess the role kind of, it changes a bit in terms of, mm-hmm. it's not, you're not filling out the squad, yeah. right? You're now, it's plugging in and plugging out,
mm-hmm.
when, yeah, contract, sure. when contracts end, when people move on. So I guess I'd love to, again, hear, now that the roster's formed, what is your day-to-day? And also, if you can give a little insight into maybe what data points you look at, mm-hmm. when looking for a player.
Yeah, sure. And okay, so day-to-day, that's an interesting one, because even that changes, like, on a daily basis.
I can imagine.
But no, my role now, obviously, I don't have to build, as you say, the roster from scratch, but there's the roster management,
yeah.
in terms of ins and outs. So for us, we try and be a very proactive department in terms of not waiting for something to happen,
yeah.
for us to sell a player or for a player to get injured and us need to replace him, whatever. We don't wait for that to happen for us to then dip into and go, okay, well, we better start looking for a centre back or a
yeah.
fullback. We like to have our ducks in line well before that, and kind of, so my day-to-day is really about kind of going, okay, well, what talent is out there that should situation X, Y, Z arise, could be a good option for us in the future.
Yeah.
So I watch a lot of football, as you can imagine, and watch a lot of games. I deal with a lot of agents and stuff who will send players into us,
yeah.
You know, trying to get their player a move, and we'll watch those and assess those players. And it's a continual process of monitoring those and adding to those lists or removing players from the list. And obviously just managing the first team as well and looking at, okay, what have we got already,
yeah.
and what how can we improve the roster?
Yeah.
So are the players we're looking at, are they going to give us value? Or are they actually going to come in and do the same job? Are they performing poorer than the players we've
yeah.
already got? So it's more about roster management on that level.
Yeah.
I do still have some involvement with the first team in terms of just overseeing the department there and
yeah.
equipment wise and making sure that the first team analyst has everything he needs from a data point of view. And ultimately, obviously, Frank's come in now and making sure that he's very different to Tata, very different in how he uses analysis. And so for us now as a department, it's about restructuring somewhat to make sure that we can provide him with everything he needs in terms of analysis. And say he brought in an analyst with him, a guy called Irwin, who is fantastic. And so for me, it's about just liaising with him and making sure that, you know, as a department, we're set for the season and mm-hmm. we're going to tick all the boxes for them as well. So it kind of comprises two elements at the moment, but say, you know, obviously the transfer window is open at the moment, and a situation can change at any moment.
Yeah.
You know, you could be with all intentions of not selling any player, but an offer comes in which is too good to turn down, and suddenly then you need to go, okay, well, we need to consider this, and if we do, what's the knock-on process to that? You know, who do we have in our list of players that is ready maybe to step up? In terms of what we look for, in terms of player, like KPIs and data points, we build things out positionally, as
yeah.
you can imagine.
Yeah.
And for every kind of position, we'll have a subset of data points which are going to be important to us to look at.
Yeah.
And then I will kind of combine all of those data points into one final data score, and we give them weightings and stuff to highlight their relevance and their importance. And it's, you know, they'll imprise some of the typical data points which you would expect for a striker. You're going to obviously look at shooting accuracy.
Correct,
and
correct, yeah.
Goals is obviously a big one, but, you know, we look at more about what they can offer us in the other areas in terms of their build-up play, their contribution to attack in general as well. And the same with defenders. You know, we're a team who likes to play out from the back, so looking at possession data for us is equally as important as looking at how good they are in winning their duels. Defenders is a more tricky one data wise because what makes a good defender is often what happens off the ball,
correct,
as opposed to on the ball. Now at the moment, unfortunately for us, there isn't much data which actually tells you anything about a player's off the ball action.
The shape. Yeah.
So for defenders, it's more a case of having to do the subjective work and maybe notate things subjectively based on what you know your team philosophies are.
Yeah.
So we'll maybe watch a game and actually just clip off the bits where it's kind of like, okay, he's in a position which we think is a good position or
yes.
not a good position, as the case may be, and that's all off the ball stuff. Say which
a lot
you
more
can't,
tactical.
Yeah, for sure, which you can't put a number on.
Yeah.
You can't say he made 10 passes in this game.
Correct.
It's more about kind of what we're seeing on the eye with defenders.
And something we spoke about earlier, and it's going to lead into, I think, a study you're doing with Emory University, is it's got to be very challenging to compare a defender for, let's say, Burnley or Stoke City, and then compare a defender from the Spanish league, so
yeah.
Real Betis or whoever it is. But, you know, their philosophy, I'm sure, in Spain is, let's keep it on the ground, let's pass. So like you said, their passing percentage or completed passes maybe for a right back at Real Betis is going to be much higher than the mm-hmm. right back at Burnley or Stoke City. And it's got to be hard because those data points will say, obviously, this guy in the Spanish league is a better passer, but in reality, you know, maybe those passes were square passes to his center back, and do they really affect the game? So I think that's where you talk about your subjectivity. It has to really look, and when you're deciding with these players and who to go for.
Yeah, 100%. That's always been a massive one, and that's even, say, if you're just looking at an individual player from whatever league it is, if you're looking at their data, the key part of analysis and the key part to any analyst's job is how you interpret the data, and then how you communicate that and present it forward. So as you said, getting a pass success rate is meaningless unless you know the direction of the passes,
correct,
the distance of the passes, the style and type of the pass. So really, for me, analysis just really always tends to ask more questions than maybe it actually answers.
Correct.
Because it leads
yeah.
you down to asking, why is the data showing that? Why is that player not having as many aerial duels as the other centre backs in the league? Whatever it is, it's kind of like, is it because actually he just gets himself in better positions where he doesn't have the challenge,
yes,
or because he's playing for a team where a lot of the play is on the floor as opposed to in the air?
Yep.
So, and the intra-league one just adds another dimension onto that.
Correct.
Because, as you said, like, different leagues have completely different styles of play, but even within that, different teams.
Yes.
Any player you look at from any team, you have to faction in the fact that the player may be playing a certain pass or making a certain run because that is what his manager has told him to do.
Yes.
So it may not be a style of the player, but it's what he's been asked to do, and so he's carrying out that instruction. And so you have to try and look beyond that and say, okay, well, what are the innate qualities that this player has in terms of whatever it is, his on the ball abilities, his athletic abilities, what are the innate qualities he has which, if we brought him into our managerial setup, we could develop and we could pull out of him.
Yeah.
So it's always a massive dilemma, and say going from league to league also is the other dilemma is, how do you rate what a good pass is or a good pass success rate is in Premier League,
yes,
compared to MLS or compared to La Liga or whatever it is? How do you say, okay, well, a 60% pass success rate in that league is going to equate to a 70% pass success rate in our league because the quality of player is slightly different or the style of play is different? So that's the incredibly tricky
part. Challenge. Yeah.
And one thing I'll say with the data, and it all ties in with that, is that we will never use it to make a decision on it. We will never use data to go, oh, this player statistically is great, let's sign him.
Yes.
It is a complete compromise of the objective data and the subjective viewing. And as I said, data almost just poses the why question.
Yeah.
The, okay, well, this is interesting. It says the data is showing this. Let's now watch him and see why the data is showing that. And you learn a lot about a player in that process.
Yeah.
So it's a complete if it has to be the two together. As you said, I'm doing some work with Emory, and we're trying to fathom a way through through that, amongst other things.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm yet to find a kind of research model or anything that kind of says, oh yeah, this is the definitive way to compare across leagues. So I'd be interested if anyone's got any ideas.
Yeah, and I think you know, I think I saw a video from you at Emory. I think you were presenting to students, and you said this one fact, and it was quite staggering, that a lot of times the manager really only remembers like 15% to 20% of what actually happens. And that's crazy. That's what you're combing through with when you're looking at these videos, is the important key parts. And that, when you said that, I was like, wow, you know, they only really remember that much, but it's the good, the really good highlighted moments, and the really bad, but everything in between that is important, or maybe not important, is stuff you've got to comb through. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and that's totally true. You know, like, we remember so little of what actually goes on because we're drawn to those exceptionally good or exceptionally bad moments. And so it's weeding through all the bits that happen in between and making people aware of those that that is our role. And it makes sense. You see, you know, the top scoring centre forward gets the headlines.
Yes.
You know, you don't see the guy who the eight maybe in the middle of the park who just keeps ball well and breaks up play. They're the very understated players because the performances aren't eye catching. But they're the players who add value, and that say data wise we can help to identify and give some recognition to as well.
Yeah. I know to the listeners, we've gone a bit over, but for me personally, I'm like geeking out over here. So sorry about this. But I think this is so interesting. So just got a couple more questions. Another kind of theme we talked about is, you know, we're individual people. We watch football. We have, we would say, players we are drawn to, players we don't fancy as much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if a coach or manager, president comes and says, hey, I want X player, but it's not really a player you fancy, it's got to be interesting because you've got to go in and say, okay, this is the job I got to do. Even though I may not really fancy this player, it's not about me, and I've got to look at his whole package. And I think that's really interesting. And I guess if you can explain, you know, how that works, because there may be times where you're like, really, this guy? You know, this is who we're going after?
Yeah, for sure. And there of course have been instances of that. Like, you're never going to go through, say, a career and have complete agreement with everybody.
Yeah.
My job is especially from the data side, to be objective.
Yes.
Is to take the tinted glasses off and just go, okay, well, this is what the data is showing.
Yeah.
From a subjective point of view, it's very different because you have your personal kind of, say, styles of play that you like or whatever.
Yes.
I have to take that out of it here.
Yeah.
You know, my job is to find players that fit the philosophy of the club.
Yeah.
And we have a very clear philosophy of player, of profile of player for each position.
Yeah.
And I've kind of been trained in that now, so I'm able to go, okay, this isn't what is right for Lucy or what I like to watch, or I may like to watch it in some cases, but it's right for Atlanta United, it's right for the club and where we are now and where we're going to be in 6 months. Because that's another thing, sometimes you bring in players who may not fit exactly the philosophy or exactly kind of where you want to go in the long term, but for the short-term needs, they could be ideal. And so you really have to try and take all of your emotions out of it at that point and go, okay, I have a clear profile of player here. And if there is a player who I really feel like does not fit that profile, my job is just to present that in video form, in statistical form, so that we have an awareness of, okay, that you like the player because of reasons X, Y, Z, and say our processes here are everybody, you know, will have to fill out detailed reports on players to say why they like them, how they fit our philosophy, and etc. So they will have that background, and they will be able to present their video or their data to support that. And then we look at the, okay, this is what they don't do so well, or this is what they don't offer us. So at the end of the day, we have both sides of the story, and we're going into that decision-making process in a much better and kind of just assured way, because the facts are there and on the table. Yeah. We know the player's strengths, we know their limitations, but for us at the moment, they are a fit because of X, Y, and Z. And it could, you know, it could be that the money is a factor as well, you know.
Which is like, big for MLS.
Of course, yeah. Like, you need a player, and yeah, we'd all love to go out and spend millions on them, but within the rules of the league and within the cap and within what we have to spend, we can't tick all of the boxes. Mm-hmm. So we know these limitations, but they're things that we may have to forego to get a player in for the money that we have available. So you have to bring that and factor that into it too as well. But yeah, some, like, to take your own personal kind of opinions out of it, it's definitely become very easy for me, because I'm so now attuned to these are the profiles of an Atlanta United player, and this is what we are looking for. So I can kind of rule somebody in or out quite quickly just based on that, irrelevant of a personal kind of like feel for a player.
So it's just so interesting. Last one here. I mean, a bit of what you're doing is risk mitigating. I mean, you're trying to make sure that who we go after, it's for the right value. We're going to get our return on investment. So can you kind of speak about that?
Yeah, and I kind of just touched on it a little bit there in terms of going, okay, well, we need to assess the strengths and weaknesses, and we need to know what the risks are. Because any player you sign, there is a risk of them being unsuccessful.
Yep.
You could buy the best player in the world. You could buy Messi, Ronaldo. There is a risk of that player coming to you and not being successful, whether it be because he gets an injury, whether it be because he moves over here and doesn't settle into the new kind of climate or the area with his teammates. It could just be because he has a natural dip in performance, which happens. There is a risk with any player. The whole kind of part of our job is helping to mitigate that risk and lessen the chances of us making a wrong decision. So we do as much homework as we can to put us in a position where we manage the risk factor. Detailed like looks at injury history, for example, their kind of background. So we look at them socially and on their social media and see, okay, do we think they're going to be a fit for us in terms of their personality and character? Because that's a risk and an area which we can help, you know, mitigate, because we can learn about their character. Obviously the playing side of things is its whole own kind of, it's a whole own section, but we look at the other things as well, say about the person themselves. Yeah. And the whole process is about risk mitigation. It is about us going, okay, when we go to Arthur and say that, you know, we need X amount to spend on a player, we need to be able to say to him that we believe that this player is going to be a success for us.
Yeah.
And we believe that because of these reasons. Now, he may come and not be a success for us. There is always that risk, but we want to make that risk as small as possible by doing all the homework we can in advance.
Yeah.
So yeah, 100%. That is what I see the job as. Reducing risk of bringing in a player who's going to be either unsuitable for your style of play or what you need at that current time, or unsuitable in the dressing room and from an injury point of view or anything like that. So yeah, it's a very good way of looking at it. Like, I totally see it as being that.
Well, Lucy, thank you again for speaking with me.
More than welcome.
I just, for one, personally, I mean, what you do, obviously, again, it's amazing and it's up my alley, but I think being one of the leaders in this, especially being a woman, is a huge credit to you. I want to say you're doing an amazing job. I just really thank you for this interview. And I believe you're on Twitter, social media.
Yes.
Do you want to shout out your Twitter handle for anyone to follow you and kind of what's up with Lucy?
Yeah. So at Lucy Rushton 12. Yeah.
Okay.
12 is the magic number.
Yeah.
So at Lucy Rushton 12. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much, guys. And again, it's such a pleasure to talk with Lucy.
very interesting person, and please, please, please continue to follow her and everything she does at Atlanta United and beyond for football.
Thanks
for being on.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, cheers.
Hey, guys. So I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Lucy. She's a really incredible individual, and I was so happy to meet with her and just learn about her journey and everything that she does with Atlanta United. I'm going to put in the description her social media handles and just a few other articles that other sports media outlets have written about her. Again, she's doing some really great things and is leading the way in terms of analytics and recruitment. In football. As always, we love your reviews, so go ahead and leave a positive review and rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And also make sure to subscribe to the podcast again on whatever podcast platform you are listening from. If you're ever looking at getting in touch with me, you can shoot me an email at tgfootballerspodcast@gmail.com. One more time, that's tgfootballerspodcast@gmail.com. We are on social media. Our Twitter handle is TGFpod. We're also on Instagram at TGFootballersPodcast. And you can find us on Facebook if you just search the Gay Footballers Podcast. I just want to thank you guys again for giving me a part of your day and supporting this podcast. Cheers.